Welcome to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up this week, everywhere that food is prepared and sold in Pennsylvania is inspected to ensure it's safe to eat. What goes into food safety inspections? Also on the program, we hear author Kaylee Barnhill's story, who may have written her last book after suffering a traumatic brain injury and post-concussion syndrome.
One of the most popular and most read features in local newspapers and websites are the food safety inspection results of restaurants and other places that prepare food. It seems that most restaurants have some violations, although many of them don't have major violations that would shut them down. The most common violations appear to be insects and equipment that isn't clean. But even those violations that are considered minor can lead to fines or even a suspension of a license if they're not corrected. Do the inspection results have an impact on diners choosing a restaurant? What actually goes into the inspections? With us on the Spark today is Shannon Powers, the press secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture. Shannon, good to see you.
It's good to be here, Scott.
All right. So why do you think those food safety inspection results are so popular in local newspapers and websites?
It's not really a mystery. We love to eat out, but nobody wants that fun experience of eating out to be marred by, you know, foodborne illness later.
Mm-hmm. And is that basically what you're looking for, is foodborne illness?
That's one of the two things. And it's not, first, we're looking to ensure that food sold in Pennsylvania is safe to eat. That's our goal. It's not, we're not out to whammy anyone. But there are, it's a risk-based system. So we look at the things that would carry a risk of making someone sick.
Mm. You said that consumers are thinking about these things. This may be anecdotal, but do you have any evidence that consumers base their decisions on where to eat, where not to eat, based on something they've seen in those inspections?
I haven't done those analytics, but we do know that they're extremely popular. They're in newspapers all around the state, on websites. We've put the information out there and tried to make it as transparent as possible. People were quite pleased when we created the Eat Safe PA app, which, you know, you can find this information not just in your local newspaper if they run it, but you can find it on our website. You can look up any restaurant or, another retail food facility, and you can find out what's their history of inspections, how do they do. You can drop a pin in the map on the Eat Safe PA app and look for places around you.
So there's actually a history there.
There's a history. You can see the past inspections there, not going back to the dawn of time.
Right.
But there is a history there. You can see recent inspections. And you can see it's very, you call up a detailed report that goes through those foodborne illness risks. But then it also goes through good management practices. And that can be things like, how the food is stored or how the utensils are stored, that kind of thing. There's a lot of details there that are just good practices. They may not make someone sick.
Who or what are inspected in Pennsylvania?
So retail food is more than just restaurant inspections. It covers pretty much any place that food is sold out of the package. In other words, not just potato chips and things that are in sealed containers. It covers food trucks, convenience stores, if they prepare food, which many of them do now. It covers restaurants and bars, hotels, that kind of places that serve food retail.
Schools.
It does cover schools, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Every school in Pennsylvania that has a cafeteria is inspected?
Absolutely.
Hmm. How often are they inspected? I mean more than schools. I mean these retail establishments, everything that you just named. How often are inspections required?
They're they're required before a restaurant opens initially. Then when it changes hands, which happens a lot. And then once a year after that, unless there are complaints or unless that restaurant during its first year hasn't had three good compliant inspections in a row. Mm-hmm. So basically once a year.
You mentioned complaints. Who would a consumer complain to? Because I would think that their first complaint would be to the manager, maybe the server, then the manager. But after that, if they want to complain, who do they complain to?
There is a space on our website, which is agriculture.pa.gov. You can look under consumer protection and you'll find food safety. And there's a food safety complaint form that you would submit to the department. But you're not complaining about service
right, and those kinds of things.
They are food safety complaints.
Mm-hmm. And what would constitute a food safety complaint for a consumer?
That's a really good question. What would constitute a food safety complaint? A lot of them are if they observe something they know is out of place, like they see something that's like a moldy ice machine, or they see insects or vermin. It can be anything, though.
Mm. The word vermin in relationship to food just doesn't really sit with me very well.
Varmints and food don't go together.
No, not at all. Not all are inspected, though, by the Department of Agriculture, are they?
That's a good point. There are approaching 100 local health departments in Pennsylvania, and those may be in tiny communities. Then there are seven county health departments, and those are mostly in the big, densely populated counties.
Yeah, Philadelphia has its own.
Allegheny.
Yeah, the bigger counties, the bigger cities. So one of the things that I've noticed is that, just reading through the results of these reports, is that most restaurants have some violations. Doesn't mean they're dirty, doesn't mean it's unhealthy, but that there are some things that they just can't avoid. Is that the case?
Well, you have to keep in mind that inspection is a surprise, so it can be at any point.
Oh, it is a surprise.
It's a surprise. So, you know, if something's like a countertop is not clean, when that inspector is there, that the inspector has to note that on the form. They're going through sort of a set of standards that all pose risks, and that would be a retail practice standard. If the countertop is not clean, or one of my favorites has always been the way that the washcloths are stored, because I am guilty of this at home. You leave the washcloth sort of wadded up on the sink and wet.
Yeah.
You know, well that is a risk that creates germs.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't create germs. That's not scientifically accurate.
Okay, so we got your favorite violation because you do it. So. But anyway, I understand where you're coming from, because some of those things that I will read in the violations, list of violations, like, whoa, I didn't even know that was a violation. But there are some that are more common than others. Insects, for example. You mentioned vermin, but rodents are another example of something that you see often. Food storage, cleanliness in the kitchen. What are some of the most common? I may have listed them all right there, but what are some of the most common violations?
Well, the ones that you've listed, the ones that reporters who do the published food safety violations are always puzzled about is the mold on the ice machine.
Mm-hmm.
You have to clean your ice machines. You have to store your utensils properly. And those kinds of things are noted. But if you'll read down the inspection form, you'll see notes at the bottom. And if something is corrected on site before that inspector leaves, that's noted. If it is not corrected, it might prompt a follow-up inspection, depending on how many violations there are. But some things are in the eyes of the consumer relatively minor, but they are requirements. You have to post the person in charge and their ServSafe license that has so issues like that.
What is considered a major violation?
A major violation, the food safety inspectors can only close a business for an imminent risk up to human health. And that, you keep bringing up vermin, that's one. And it's not always something that's under the owner's control. That's a big thing to point out. For example, if it's flood season, if the restaurant floods, you can't stay open safely and serve food safely. If you have no hot water, which may be out of your control, you can't sanitize anything properly, so you can't stay open until that issue is corrected. So there are all kinds of issues like that. If there is a big opening that's letting in those insects, then you have to fix that.
Yeah. Very often when you talk about insects or you talk about rodents, it comes in the form of maybe a package, a box that has arrived from the distributor. That it's not necessarily that the establishment is dirty or anything, but that, you know, an insect or a mouse or something has, you know, hitched a ride on something, right?
Right. Or if you, for example, live along a river, there is, you know, you have particular challenges based on your location. If you live along a river, if you have a, you know, lovely pastoral restaurant that's alongside a field, you have different risks than other people have.
Shannon, you mentioned when an establishment is shut down that something is imminent. Is that the only time something's shut down, or if there are multiple violations?
That's the only time that we can shut something down. Now, local codes can shut something down too. That's aside from food safety, like building code issues, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But we can only shut it down if there's an imminent risk to human health. And sometimes it is the severity of the particular violation that does that.
So if there is an establishment that has a lot of violations month after month, because they've been inspected multiple times, even though they're considered minor, they don't add up to a shutdown.
Follow-up inspections to correct issues that have not been corrected and need to be corrected could lead to fines and a hearing and that sort of thing. But that's really not common.
So if there is a violation, what happens to the establishment?
Well, the reports are posted and they're easy to find. And typically, you know, so we're trying to be as transparent as possible. There's no penalty for the establishment. That's not what it's about. It's about educating their staff, working with those business owners to make sure that their customers are safe. That's what every business owner wants. Nobody wants to make their customers sick.
Mm-hmm. But there does reach a point where fines can be imposed and court action taken, right?
That is correct. It wouldn't be court action. It would be an administrative action, typically. Mm-hmm.
Walk us through a food safety inspection, if you can. I don't know whether you've ever actually been on one or not. I know that the farm show, we were talking beforehand, you said the farm show always gets a lot of attention. But if you could, just kind of walk us through a food safety inspection, what the inspectors are looking for.
Well, the easiest way to do that is actually to look up a form on our food safety inspection reports. They're going through a checklist, and the violations that are listed in the PA Food Code are numbered. And you can actually look up how frequent a violation is. There's all kinds of data there beyond just looking up those individual reports. But walk us through an inspection. They're going to first observe the facility itself, things like a big gap in a screen door, or they're going to notice, are the sinks in the right place? Are they clean? They go through this checklist. So they're walking around and looking. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's been a long time since I've been on a food safety inspection, but the first thing they look for is that person in charge present, and is that serve safe license to show that they're trained, is that posted? And then they go through, they walk around with that person, and they talk with that person about things that they need to do a better job of.
You know, this is an anecdotal thing, but I wonder if there was any correlation. I've often heard that if a restroom is clean, or depending on how clean it is, that correlates to the rest of the establishment, but especially the kitchen. Anything to that?
I have no idea whether anyone's done that research, but absolutely the restroom, the standards for the restroom, they need to have the posted notice that you always see about whether or not the staff have washed their hands. Hand washing is a big thing. And that's one of those things that people are surprised at. If you have a retail food place, you have to have a hand washing sink that's separate from your dishwashing sink. And that's important for kind of obvious reasons when you think about it, but a lot of people don't think about that.
Yeah. What about gloves and hair nets, beard nets, that kind of thing? What's the law say?
Wow, you've asked one that I actually don't know the answer to.
Okay.
But that is likely to be listed under the retail practices.
Food temperature regulations. This is something that a lot of people do pay attention to food temperatures, especially when it comes to beef, for example. My daughter has a thing about well done versus extremely well done or medium rare or that kind of thing. You know, that is something that I'm sure inspectors are looking for.
Absolutely. And the requirements for an establishment are based on the kind of food they serve. For example, you know, I'm a big lover of seafood and shellfish, but shellfish requires storage at certain temperatures. It requires certain sanitation practices. It's one of those things. One of the retail food licenses that we didn't mention was you can register to produce retail food in your home, like jams and jellies and cookies are a frequent thing, but it comes with, again, inspection and requirements. You can't register to produce shellfish in your home and sell at retail.
Really?
Residential kitchen can't meet those kind of requirements.
Oh, I was going to say that there are some foods that are more sensitive to problems, and shellfish obviously is one where you do hear about people getting sick. I was reading through you know, some of the regulations, saw that chicken and poultry have to be on the bottom shelves of a freezer. You know why?
Oh, I should know that one, too. it's because if there is a fluctuation in temperature, it risks the food that's stored below it. And what's even more important than, that's one of those frequent violations that you mentioned. The food maybe not be properly labeled that's in the refrigerator. Aside from the temperature that it's kept at, it has to be properly labeled so that you can tell you're not using something that's past its prime. But also out in your, not just your serving environment, but your cooking environment, you don't store cleaning products above where you're preparing or serving food because that poses a risk if you spill it. We had a very prominent poisoning case a number of years back in this region where that was exactly what had happened. It was a salad bar.
Yeah.
Couldn't think of that word.
Yeah.
It was a salad bar, but there had been a cleaner stored improperly, and it had fallen over and
gotten
in the food.
And, again, kind of sickening to think about it.
It is, but it can happen.
If I remember correctly, it was a child that got sick and got really sick.
I believe so, yes. It was a tragic situation, but it just goes to show you the risks everything is based on risks.
So what should consumers look for when they're looking at your website or, you know, in the safety inspections that are in the newspaper on websites?
Well, you can see what kind of inspection it is, when it was. You can see how frequently they're inspected. And make sure that you scroll down that page on the inspection report to see the notes, because they may have corrected the issue. There's an FAQ there. There's a lot of information at agriculture.pa.gov under consumer protection. Or on the Eat Safe PA app is another way to get to it from anywhere you are.
I would imagine that there are some establishments out there that these inspection reports have either kept consumers from going there or maybe even attracted them because they get a good report.
I'm sure that's true.
So it is in the business owner's best interest to make sure that everything is safe and everything will be clean. So one question, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but there seems to be some question about days, use-by dates, eat-by dates
on food. Now, this doesn't necessarily come down to safety inspections, although I'm sure they look at some of the dates on those things. But can you clear that up?
You've asked the most complicated question with no time left.
Well, we got about 30 seconds.
And that's not the Bureau of Food Safety at the Department of Agriculture doesn't govern that. But they do look at the products in a retail kitchen to see if they are if there are products there that are past their use-by date or past their sell-by date.
There's a whole show we can do on that.
That would be a big one.
Whether I can eat something that says sell-by dates and eat-by dates, that kind of thing. Shannon Powers is the press secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture. Shannon, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
Coming up on the second half of the Spark Weekly, we hear author Kelly Barnhill's story, who may have written her last book after suffering a traumatic brain injury and post-concussion syndrome. You're listening to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar.
Welcome back to the Spark Weekly. I'm Marquise Lupton. Children's author and Newbery Award winner Kelly Barnhill is taking life one sentence at a time, literally. This is due to a traumatic brain injury in 2021 that Kelly has no recollection of. And now she claims that her brain is broken. We chatted it up with the Minnesota author about how life is after her injury, and we discuss her recovery and, of course, her latest book, The Ogress and the Orphans. Hello, Kelly. How are you doing today?
It's really a pleasure to be here.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So let's just get right into things here. It's going to sound very, very forward, but can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, I'm happy to. First of all, I should mention that this was not my first concussion. I'm a bit of a klutz, as I've learned, and also terribly unlucky. And one thing that I have learned about post-concussive syndrome is that the more concussions you have, the longer it takes to recover. And it's like any other injury, right? You know, our bodies respond with inflammation, right? You know, your bum knee, that every time you knock it out, it just takes longer, right? Mm. The brain is no different. So I do remember walking up the stairs to turn the light off in my kid's bedroom. And so I don't know what happened next, if I missed a step, if I tripped on the dog, or some other dumb thing. But what I do know is that my husband heard a loud sound and a big thunk. And he found me at the bottom of the stairs, completely unconscious.
Oh my gosh.
And then the next period of time is, you know, kind of a blur. I know they took me to the hospital and did a bunch of things over there. But part of recovering from a concussion is that you don't remember a lot of things. It's actually pretty common, to not remember the point of fall or even the period of time leading up to it as well.
So how has this affected your ability to write? What is it that you can and cannot do any longer, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, that's totally fine. So it's interesting. I mean, first of all, you know, all of this happened and 2 months later, I had a book come out. Mm. And 2 months after that, I had another book come out.
Wow.
And so I had to somehow manage the rollout of these pieces of literature while, you know, being just not my full self. Mm-hmm. So there was that that particular conundrum. But in the midst of all of that, one of the things that can happen to people, particularly in the early days after a concussion, is aphasia. And so I had to relearn how to speak sentences without losing words. And that was a very tricky operation and kind of scary. Mm. And another thing is fatigue and brain fog, which I had never experienced brain fog before, but boy, it's terrible. Mm. My heart is out to anybody who's experiencing it right now. And the third thing, and the thing that was really tricky with writing, is that I had to relearn how to write in cursive.
Oh.
So all of my books I write in longhand. And there's something very sort of cognitively dynamic with cursive writing. It's one of the reasons why they will reteach people how to write in cursive, like after a stroke or other kinds of anyway, as you can see, I sometimes still lose words even now. Anyway, after some kind of brain event, right? And so I had to relearn how to write in cursive. And so I literally bought those workbooks that we had when we were children, you know, Danelian or whatever, and practicing writing the letter A sort of again and again. I had to practice writing a full word without my hand and brain getting lost in it. And as I was doing that, that was also when I was kind of relearning how to slow down and allow my sentences to sort of fall into place. I learned how, I'm kind of a fast talker, as you can probably hear, which is also a problem. And so learning how to slow down and allowing my brain to find the words without panicking about finding the words, right? Which allowed me to not have those moments of aphasia, which are really troubling and kind of scary, I think, for people. It certainly was scary for me.
When did you know that something wasn't right? Was it the next day? Was it when you were out with a family? When were you able to pinpoint that, hold on, something's not right here?
Yeah, I mean, certainly right away, there was no question that I was very injured. I had another concussion, you know, a few years earlier when I tripped when I was running. I had another concussion when I slipped on the ice while I was running. I've had these things happen before, so it wasn't my first rodeo. I knew to expect that I was going to be really tired, that I would have really bad headaches, that I would, you know, have sensitivity to light and sound. I knew all of that was going to happen, right? And so did the people around me. So what I did start to notice, though, that it was just lasting a lot longer than it did before. But also that things were happening in my life that I wasn't remembering. We went to Florida to celebrate the holiday with family, and I had no memory of it at all by January. So I was realizing that had happened, and that was troubling. But also, you know, the way in which an injured brain responds to that injury is by really, you know, prioritizing sleep. People who have gotten a concussion are really, really tired. And this is true of a lot of neurological injuries. It's one of the reasons why people with long COVID are so tired, right? Because neurological injury is really exhausting. Our neurons are so complex and so dynamic that it just takes, and our brains are such an energy suck for our entire bodies. They use more energy than any other part of our body does. So of course it takes a lot of energy. I was sleeping probably 18 to 20 hours a day.
Wow.
I would sleep 10 hours at night, and then I'd be up for a little bit, and then I would take a 4-hour nap, and then be up for a little bit, and then take another 4-hour nap. I mean, it was just so much sleeping. And we knew that was on its way, that was the experience. But my husband and I started to realize that wow, this is just lasting way longer. The other thing was double vision. So I wasn't able to drive for about 9 months
Wow.
after my injury, because I was just seeing double all the time, and so which was one of the reasons why that's another reason why you're so tired is just the work of seeing becomes so again energy dense. So I could bring my vision together, but it was a lot of work. And as the day went, so it would make me tired, and then as I would get tired, it was harder and harder to do. And I remember there was one time I was sitting there next to my husband on the couch, and I said, you know, I see two of you right now, and he said, lucky for you, I'm so handsome, which fair, true facts. And so all of this, I mean, in the face of all of this, it wasn't even occurring to me that like, it's going to be hard to write fiction again. And that really came later on. And I realized there were two things going on. I mean, first of all, so one of the things that I started to do was I would just write a sentence on a note card, right? And I knew that I needed to have some kind of creative practice. And I knew that I was really tired. And I knew that even like writing emails, looking at screens was really, really hard for me at the time. I would have to have somebody read it to me and then tell them what to write. This was also true. So I had one more book that was sort of in the pipeline, and we were still in the midst of copy edits. And my family had to help me with that. They would say, okay, the editor says this, you know, do you agree or not? And I would have to listen and respond. And again, I could only do it for very short periods of time before I would have to go and lie down. So I had this, I knew that I just needed to make something beautiful every day. Just a sentence that pleased me, that looked correct on the card, and that felt good to say. And that was really the extent of my creative life. After a little while, I was able to do more, but I still wasn't able to write fiction. And one of the things that we have to do as writers when we're writing fiction is that we're holding a lot of thoughts all at once, right? We are holding all of these discrete pieces of information about each character, about each character's arc, about these moments of light in this scene and this scene and this scene. And we're holding them all together at once, all at the same time. It's really a lot of work. Right. It requires you to be holding a lot of thoughts at once. I used to describe it as having a room full of pins, and you have to set little globes on each one and set them spinning, and then try not to let any of them fall. That's what it felt like for me writing fiction. And one of the things that became very clear to me in my recovery is that I was really only able to hold one thought at a time. And I made all kinds of tasks, like normal tasks just around the house, really hard. Suddenly it took, you know, 3 hours to empty the dishwasher. The laundry was a monumental task. Just sweeping the floor just took forever because all of those, we don't really think of these like just simple household tasks as being very sort of like cognitively complex, that we're holding a lot of things, that we're doing a lot of things at once, but we actually are. It's why we still don't have household robots, right? Because these jobs are hard. I realized that I'm really only able to hold one thought at a time, which on one hand, and one of the reasons why I was able to realize this, that this is what was going on with me, is that for the first time in a long time, I was not experiencing anxiety. At all. I've had anxiety my whole life. That's sort of like racing thoughts and like, you know, you're stacking all kinds of things. So anxiety is a narrative disorder, and it requires us to stack a lot of thoughts all really sometimes extremely high all the way up to the sky, right? And you're sort of like cycling through back and forth and up and down. And by only having one thought in my head at a time, it meant that I no longer had that anxiety response to really anything. Which was kind of awesome, you know, but also I couldn't do this work that I loved, which was devastating. So it was sort of a the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away kind of a situation, you know?
Yeah.
And so in a lot of ways, like, it's okay, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I actually do have this sense of peace about it, that that I'm able to you know, sit and think about this experience. And I was able to write an essay. It took me forever. Boy, oh boy, did it take me forever. And I could only do it by writing one sentence at a time on cards. That's how I was able to take on that task. But the story that I was telling was only about me. Right.
Yeah.
I didn't have to hold multiple thoughts and notions and pieces of information together. All I had to do was, you know, write one sentence at a time and assemble it literally on the floor of my office until it kind of looked right and I could like get it all to hang together. Fiction doesn't work that way.
So before we get into the meat and potatoes and the details of that, how did you write this book?
Well, I'll tell you what. So the Ogres and the Orphans, of course, is before my most recent concussion, although after my last one. But what was interesting about the Ogres and the Orphans is that, you know, I had the idea for this book and I wasn't exactly sure how I was going to execute it. It began literally as a picture book. I thought I was writing a picture book, which is hilarious because it's a 400-page novel. Ha ha ha. But I really, you know, we were in this period of time where you know, sort of midway through the last presidential administration, and I was noticing just the tenor of how people spoke to one another was getting meaner and more grasping. That people were using this kind of negativity and this demeaning language as a way of elevating themselves, as being able to get on, you know, like whatever news programs and getting people to write checks.
Yeah.
And that was so devastating for me. And so I was playing with this idea of what does it mean to be a good neighbor? What does it mean to have a beloved community? What does that mean? And what happens if you have a beloved community that loses its way and loses its mind? Right. And I wasn't really sure how to do that. I wasn't sure how that would work in a story. And so I was playing around with fairy tales. Whenever I sort of have a time in my life when I'm not writing, where I'm not really feeling it, I return to fairy tales, which is always the source for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was writing myself fairy tales every single day. And then recycling them. It was like chalk drawings, you know. And then I had one that just was sort of sticking around and wasn't leaving me alone. And so I messed with it and messed with it and messed with it until finally, like, I had it in my head of how I wanted the book to sound, how I wanted the story to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing it, and it was January of 2020. When I started writing this book in earnest, I mean, at the time, you know, we heard about this virus that was, you know, far, far away, and people were worried that it would come here, but like probably it wouldn't, and probably would sort of stay away, but it seemed kind of scary. We weren't really sure. There is a moment in the book where, it talks about a community that like was, you know, sort of like wonderful and giving and functional, and then something happened to cause people to close their doors and to separate and to not speak to their neighbors anymore. It was weird that I was writing that literally as we were starting to shut down, which was a strange place to be, you know. And then I finished that book, which, you know, also, you know, involves the burning down of a library, which was sort of this seminal, terrible event. Right as there was this eruption of rage and pain and disappointment in my city in Minneapolis, that June. So it was a strange time to be writing a book. It was a strange time to be writing a book that was like, that felt like, it was being, pushed against by the world as it was happening, you know? And then it was a strange time to be, out, like discussing it with, you know, children and readers in sort of a, in my broken state. But at the same time, like as hard as all of that was, it is still like a, it's an experience I treasure at the same time. Like if it is true, if this is my last book, and I don't know, I'm just sort of like, I'm willing to sort of like, accept the world as it sort of accepts me and to accept whatever path that I'm on, with sort of love and grace. If this is my last book, like I'm okay with that, because it mattered so much to me, like the writing of it mattered so much to me, the sharing of it mattered so much to me. If this is how I go out, awesome.
Is that how I feel? So Kelly, we have about 45 seconds left here. So what is next? If you could tell us real quick.
Well, great question. So I had a book come out this last year that I wrote before but came out after, called The Crane Husband, which is a deeply, deeply weird book. And I hope that people like it. Other than that, you know, continuing to live and breathe and seek beauty. And maybe that will be written down, and maybe that will just be written on my heart. I don't know.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And I will tell you this, Kelly, you said that laundry is a monumental task for you now. I'll tell you this, laundry is always a monumental task. I want to thank you for joining us on The Spark today. This has been fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to The Spark Weekly and making us a part of your day. And on behalf of Scott Lamar and myself, we want to wish you a happy spring and an even happier week. And on Monday on The Spark, Scott Lamar speaks with Megan Robertson, who was featured on Finding Your Roots. And I speak with Norma Vasquez about breastfeeding and her advocacy surrounding breastfeeders around the region. You're listening to The Spark Weekly. I'm Marquise Lupton, and have yourself a nice day.